Biblical sexuality is an important topic, and there are parts to the agenda that we need to look into a little bit closer. One of them is the influence on the gospel. So, in a sense, the LGBT agenda is a declaration of war on the gospel. How is that? Well, if the government can declare that sin is no longer sin, then obviously you do not need a savior to wash us from our sins, as Revelation 1:5 says. And now, not just Christians and Jews, but even Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, and other native religions believe that God made man and woman. And so today we're seeing the government step into the realm of theology and enforcing religious conformity. And so the message from the government is change your religious beliefs or the government will come after you. Similar to Nebuchadnezzar, who demanded that everyone bow to his statue when the trumpets were blown, or they would get thrown in the fiery furnace. Now, gender confusion is a first world problem. It affects most those who have gone through the public educational system, liberal colleges, universities, or those who consume large amounts of media. Third world problems are still trying to get food on the table and clean water. And so we see this in the first world. Now, one aspect of this agenda is feelings. The gospel teaches us to renew our mind, to take control of our thoughts and feelings. But this new sexual agenda teaches a belief system that your feelings control you. Your feelings define you. Do you feel like a boy? Do you feel like a girl? Do you have same-sex feelings? But since your feelings change like the weather, you live in a continual uncertainty of life. You live at the mercy of these fluid feelings. Interestingly, they teach that whatever you feel is okay, unless, of course, what you feel is like following the Bible. Now, original sin. The Bible explains that God made everything good and that Adam and Eve, after he made them, he said it was very good. But then Adam and Eve sinned, and everyone born from Adam and Eve since then has a sinful nature spliced into their DNA. So from the fall of the garden, the carnal thoughts of man, like gravity, tend toward evil continually. It's called the fallen nature, or the flesh, or original sin. So each person is born with a feeling, an attraction to temptation, a predisposition towards sin, such as lying. Nobody has to teach a child how to lie. They just learn, they display that. Cheating, greed, theft, anger, violence, pride, and lust. Adultery, fornication, pedophilia, sodomy, murder, rape, etc. All of these things are part of fallen human nature. And so Genesis 8:21, before the flood, God said, "The imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth." The book of Proverbs says, "There is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof is death." And so your feelings can lead you in a wrong direction. So every human being is born with these tendencies. There's even a homosexual candidate for president of the United States, and he commented, "I was born this way." Well, the fact of the matter is everyone was born this way. Everyone was born with a sinful tendency toward the flesh. That is why Jesus said you must be born again. That you must experience the rebirth of the gospel. And it's like a computer downloading a new operating system. And so Jesus Christ came, died on the cross to pay the penalty for our sins so that through him, sinners could be forgiven, redeemed, reunited with God, and your old flesh nature and its fleshly tendencies is replaced with a selfless, self-sacrificing nature. Now, sinful desires can be manipulated. You know, humans train animals by rewarding behavior with pleasure, often a tasty treat. There's the old picture of a boy sitting on a donkey, dangling a carrot by a string on the end of a stick, hanging it in front of the donkey's eyes to get the donkey to keep walking. So this donkey sees that carrot right in front of its eyes and it says, oh, I just want to get a little closer. And the animal does not see the big picture. It is just motivated by wanting that treat. An example is a dog show. So the dog obeys its master because after every trick, the master discreetly pulls a treat out of his pocket and slips it to the dog. The dog is oblivious to the larger agenda, such as the owner wanting to win a large prize and gain recognition in front of millions of people watching on TV. In the same way, the behavior of men and women can be manipulated by dangling the pleasure of sex outside of the confines of biblical marriage. Genesis explains that man is made in the image of God. Once man sinned, Satan was intent on distorting the image of God. So Satan manipulates man's desire for sex to get them to commit a whole host of immoral acts, like that treat dangling before the donkey or given to the dog. Women needing money could be tempted to engage in the oldest profession. The world even acknowledges this powerful draw towards sex and harnesses it for sales. And marketing executives use the adage, sex sells. So you'll see a billboard on the highway of a car repair shop, but it'll have a pretty girl in there. The girl has nothing to do with car repair, but everyone knows it'll attract the view of the men going down the highway. So the bigger picture, why would Satan want to dangle and move humankind in a direction? Well, one of the tactics that is used is deconstruction. It's a way to move a population on a large scale in a certain direction. It's actually a communist tactic. And so the idea is after the Cold War, the United States is so strong and the Soviets and communists would come up with concepts on how to defeat America from the inside because they couldn't defeat from the outside. So this tactic called deconstruction, it's a drive neutral reverse process where people are separated from their past historically and morally by portraying the past negatively, portraying the founders as, you know, religious tyrants and intolerant and so forth. And then the students become open-minded. Well, if they're emotionally detached from the past, they're now open-minded. But then the next step is they can be indoctrinated with a new ideology, a new identity. It's sort of gene replacement therapy for a nation. And it actually mirrors a sales technique. So if I were a toothpaste salesman, the first thing I would do is say negative things about the toothpaste you're currently using. You're still using that old stuff? Don't you know it'll eat the enamel off your teeth? Ooh, you're repulsed by it. Now I have you in a neutral position. You're open-minded. What are all the toothpastes out there nowadays? Then I give you my pitch for this brand new tartar control breath freshening toothpaste. This technique is applied in schools. So they first go into the school and teach the kids negative things about the founding fathers. They took land from Indians and they were slave owners and they were evil and chauvinists and they used textbooks like Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. And yikes, the students are repulsed by America's founders. They're all terrible. And so the students move into a neutral position. They're no longer emotionally attached to the founders. They're open-minded. Then you give the students the pitch for your new identity, whether it be socialism or LGBT or Islam. And the students are peer pressured and indoctrinated with novel concepts of white privilege, intersectionality, and common core curriculum. So they move drive neutral reverse. They move, they detach from the country's founders, they get into an open-minded stage, and then they're indoctrinated with a new identity. So just as a car goes from drive into neutral before it goes into reverse, this process has taken place in Western civilization. Let's look at Europe. Europe's gone from a Judeo-Christian Europe into a secular Europe, and now it's entering a socialist Islamic Europe. Let's go through this slowly. So Europe, for millennium was Judeo-Christian. It was Catholic, it had the Jewish neighborhoods, had a Protestant Reformation, but it was predominantly Judeo-Christian. And then Europe went into a secular phase, a neutral phase with the French Revolution. Robespierre was the head of France's Committee on Public Safety, their equivalent of Homeland Security. He puts a prostitute in Notre Dame Cathedral, covers her with a sheet, and says, "This is the goddess of reason, let's worship her." The whole nation casts off their sexual restraints in this secular pursuit. And then Robespierre in 1793 begins the Reign of Terror. 40,000 people are beheaded in Paris for not abandoning their faith and embracing secularism. Paris then sent its military to the Vendée, a rural area that's very Catholic, and the soldiers kill over 300,000 men, women, and children, forcing them to comply with the secular state. And then Napoleon spreads all this French secularism around Europe. And so Europe effectively cuts ties with its Judeo-Christian past. So it went from Judeo-Christian past, secular French Revolution, neutral, and the neutral phase tolerates anything. Atheism, free sex, LGBT agenda. Years ago, we were visiting someone in Berlin, and we were walking around a very beautiful lake. People were swimming in the lake and coming out, and they were naked. And the person I was with says, "Don't look, just keep walking." And it was this anything goes mentality. But then Europe is being changed through the bringing in of Islam. And so you see that with all these immigrants, Europe is entering an Islamic future, with Muhammad being the number one name for newborns in London, Brussels, Paris, Milan. Europeans are having fewer and fewer children. The Muslims can have four wives, they can draw welfare, and they can have many, many children. And so there are now 5 million Muslim immigrants surrounding the city of Paris, over 700 neighborhoods. Women are raped on the streets of Germany and Sweden and Denmark. Trucks being driven into crowds, historic cathedrals being vandalized. And so you see a trend, drive, neutral, reverse. Judeo-Christian Europe, secular French Revolution, gay Europe, and now it's turning into an Islamic Europe. And so we've gone from Bibles in the schools to condoms in the schools, now it's hijabs in the schools. Now, an African archbishop named Robert Serra of Guinea told the Synod of Bishops in Rome, October 12th of 2015, like two apocalyptic beasts, on the one hand, atheistic secularism, on the other, Islamic fundamentalism. We find ourselves between gender ideology and ISIS. Two major threats, disintegration in the secularized West through quick and easy divorce, abortion, homosexual unions, euthanasia, etc., the LGBT lobby. And on the other hand, Islam, which legitimizes polygamy, female subservience, sexual slavery, child marriage, etc., Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Boko Haram. Another bishop, Italian Archbishop Carlo Liberti, stated January 14, 2017, "We have a weak Christian faith. Seminaries are empty. Italy and Europe live in a pagan, atheistic way. They make laws that go against God. They have traditions that are proper to paganism. All this paves the way to Islam. Europe will soon be Muslim." So this drive, neutral, reverse process, Judeo-Christian past, secular, free sex, LGBT, neutral, and then an Islamic, socialist, communist future. Europe is almost past the point of no return, and America is advancing in that same direction. One interesting anthropologist, his name is J.D. Unwin, U-N-W-I-N, and he wrote a book in 1934. The title of his book is Sex and Culture. Now, why do we look at this? Well, history is not prophetic, but it is predictive. Past behavior is the best indicator of future performance. So he looked at the past behavior, where he examined 80 different cultures throughout 5,000 years of recorded human history. And he looked at the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Anglo-Saxons, dozens of others in all kinds of different geographic settings, environmental settings, and different racial makeups. And he found something, that 100% of the time, there is a correlation between heterosexual marriage fidelity and cultural development, and absolutely no exceptions to this rule. So he observed that cultures go through four stages: pain, productive, prosperous, promiscuous. So first, they go through pain, maybe like after World War II and Europe is poor. And then they become productive and they're making money and building factories. And then they become prosperous. And then they become promiscuous. And so this trend happened in America. We had the pain of the Great Depression. And then we become productive with our factories and making cars and so forth. Then we become prosperous. And then we have the 1960s with promiscuous. And so we see this trend happening. And J.D. Unwin observed cultures going through these stages. But other psychologists studied this. One was Sigmund Freud. And so they found that promiscuity and the loosening of sexual restrictions always leads to cultural and civilizational decline. So in the same way that a woman has a natural impulse to protect an innocent baby and provide for it, so the males have a strong sex drive that can be harnessed because they want it fulfilled, and it's harnessed in them pursuing a woman in marriage. And then he has a motivation to provide for this woman. And there's the old little nursery rhyme, first comes love, then comes marriage, and then comes Susie with the baby carriage, right? But it's this idea that the man, his initial thought is he just wants this sexual gratification, but he's only allowed to get it because the woman won't give herself outside of these confines of a commitment of marriage. And so he's motivated to make the commitment because he has this extra drive. Once the commitment's made, then there's a family, and then he's motivated to want to protect and provide for the family. And so J.D. Unwin examines this phenomenon. And so the man ends up becoming creative and hardworking to provide for it. The word husband comes from the word house bond, which means he's bound to the house, he's bound to the home, he's bound to the family. He has a band. He's a band that surrounds it. He's bound to his wife. So the man has a daily impulse and incentive to use his mental and physical strength to the maximum so that he can go home at night and have gratification with his wife. We know this is on a sort of basic level, but this was the observation of J.D. Unwin. So if all the men are acting this way and they're all being really productive so they can go home and provide for their wife and protect their wife and family, the cumulative societal effect of all these men doing this provides a powerful, productive, and prosperous country. But once the country becomes prosperous, women are freed up from the homes. They're freed up from home chores, they're given more independence, and the phenomenon has been labeled feminism. But in other eras of history, it was labeled other things. But feminism frees the woman from having to have children and liberates her sexually, allowing men to fulfill their sex drive without the commitment of marriage and without the commitment of having to provide for wife and family. So water seeks its own level. Men will find the easiest way to fulfill their sex drive. So as water goes down a hill and seeks the path of least resistance, a man's sexual drive is directed to the quickest and easiest path to fulfillment. And so his focus becomes on his self-gratification, his sexual impulse, which J.D. Unwin called societal or cultural energy, is squandered on selfishness, not on building a prosperous, productive home and all the men together, a country. So feminism produces less masculine males and more self-sufficient women who have little need for men, especially if the government helps provide for the woman. So the woman, if you look at the Will and Ariel Durant, they observed dozens of cultures throughout history. And they found that when cultures are less advanced, they have children sooner and have more of them. As cultures become more prosperous and advanced, they wait to have children and have fewer of them. And so we see that as the country becomes prosperous, the women have fewer children, and that weakens the country with a decreased population. Again, this is 5,000 years of history and over 80 different cultures examined, looking at what causes them to rise and fall. So in what Unwin referred to as the sexual marketplace, if men can easily purchase sexual fulfillment in premarital sex, postmarital sex, cohabitation, homosexual, pedophile, pederast relationships, the social energy is dissipated. Men become increasingly lazy, decadent, less civilized, less creative, and less productive. This is, again, 1934, J.D. Unwin's book, Sex and Culture. He noticed the three major world religions were structured around marriage, monogamy, and restraint on sexual activity. So in other words, the three major religions channeled this male drive that to the confines, again, hanging that carrot in front of the donkey, saying, if you want this fulfillment, you have to pursue this direction. Well, these three major world religions says, okay, you have to move in the direction of following these rules. And the energy was directed to provide for the wife and family, and collectively that made the countries more prosperous. And so the restraints on activity, sexual activity. You know, Catherine Lee Bates, who wrote the hymn, America the Beautiful, there's a line in that beautiful song that says, confirm thy soul in self-control. So again, America, we have this foundation of self-control. Unwin noticed that once a nation goes down this path of pain, of productive, of prosperous, of promiscuity, once they start going in the promiscuity path, they never recover. That it's always fatal toward the death of that culture. Now, it can be delayed, and that's our prayer, is that we can delay this. John Adams wrote to Thomas Jefferson in 1819. He said, have you ever found in history one single example of a nation thoroughly corrupted that was afterwards restored to virtue? And without virtue, there could be no political liberty? Will you tell me how to prevent luxury from producing effeminacy, intoxication, extravagance, vice, and folly? He ends, no effort in favor of virtue is lost. So J.D. Unwin documented that in every single instance, sexual promiscuity internally weakens a country, which is then conquered by more masculine, aggressive countries. Without exception, once restrictions on sexuality are lifted, especially the female sexuality, a society destroys itself from within and then is weakened and conquered from without. Aldous Huxley, author of Brave New World, 1932, wrote, Unwin's conclusions are based upon an enormous wealth of carefully sifted evidence. The cultural condition of a society rises in exact proportion as it imposes pre-nuptial and post-nuptial restraints upon sexual opportunity. Alex McFarlane, who is one of the presenters in this series, summarized this saying, fire inside the fireplace is productive, providing heat for cooking and warming the house, but fire outside the fireplace is destructive, burning it down. So the male sexual drive, when it's in the confines of the fireplace of a covenant of marriage, then it's productive because it causes him to want to be creative and industrious so that he can provide for his wife and family. But outside the confines of marriage, that drive is destructive. So we need to look at a larger agenda. The LGBTQ activists cannot see the larger agenda. Why? Because their agenda is lust-driven. And lust, by definition, blinds you to the effects of lust. So a large fish sees a fisherman's lure, but does not see the disguised fish hook underneath. So you have a successful businessman. He sees a pretty secretary. He thinks of immediate pleasure. He does not think ahead that he will lose his marriage, alienate his children, be shamed in the community, lose his business, and die alone in a hotel room somewhere. He doesn't see that. He just sees immediate pleasure. And so the LGBT movement is an immediate pleasure movement. It cannot see the long-term effects of its agenda. It cannot see that the teaching of it in schools will produce lawless students who have no concept of right and wrong. There's no absolutes. That they are ruled by their fluid feelings, which allow them to justify any action, including killing babies. Some students act out what they've been taught, and they justify killing their classmates. After all, everyone just evolved from a swamp, and there's no purpose to life. So this results in more people in the society having lawlessness, and there's insecurity for life and property as a result, and this begins to have the people call for a strong power to restore order, be that a controlling government or an Islamic Sharia system. So LGBTQ activists do not realize that they are just the first step in a larger agenda that if you remove the moral restraints, it leads to more crime, which leads to more government, which will allow elite ruling class to usurp power, after which a party boss will usurp enough power to be a dictator. This is a similar situation to King Saul became a dictator, right? The power of the country of Israel was concentrated. This is how Caesar usurped power, and even Napoleon usurped power this way. Now, Hitler, he used a group of homosexuals called brown shirts to spread violence and domestic chaos. But once Hitler seized power, he executed the brown shirts in the Night of the Long Knives. So he used them, and so this sexual confusion brings chaos out of which a dictator arises. Lenin used the term useful idiots to describe those poor peasants that could be motivated by greed and revenge to take away the farms from the farm owners. But these poor peasants could not see the bigger picture, that their actions were disrupting society and bringing chaos and insecurity, which would allow a tyrant to seize power and to set up a totalitarian dictatorship, which would enslave them. So again, like training a dog, all the person thinks about is that immediate gratification. So could some politicians have a larger agenda? Could some globalist financial elites have a larger agenda, a one world government agenda? Well, one only need ask. If politicians can justify killing an innocent unborn baby, is there anything they can't justify? What is spreading destabilizing immorality or lying or cheating or slander or voter fraud in comparison with killing an innocent baby? Machiavelli made a statement that community organizer Saul Alinsky quoted, "In war, the ends justifies the means. The end, their utopian global government, is so good that any nefarious tactic to get there is justified." So let's trace this domino effect. Let's break it down. So you have sexual sin leads to unwanted pregnancy. Unwanted pregnancy leads to abortion. Abortion leads to justify killing babies who survived abortions, which justifies infanticide, as the governor of Virginia not too long ago advocated, death of babies born with handicaps, and then even the selling of body parts that Planned Parenthood has the documented videos of. And so all this leads to a general lowering of the value of human life, which leads to more crime and violence. Mother Teresa of Calcutta stated at the National Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C., February 3, 1994, with Bill and Hillary Clinton in attendance. Mother Teresa said, "The greatest destroyer of peace today is abortion, because it is a war against the child, a direct killing of the innocent child, murder by the mother herself. If we can accept that a mother can kill even her own child, how can we tell other people not to kill one another?" She goes on, "Any country that accepts abortion is not teaching its people to love, but to use violence to get what they want. That is why the greatest destroyer of love and peace is abortion." Powerful words from Mother Teresa. So if you have abortion, and then you have the lowering of the value of human life, and then there's more crime, and more crime leads to insecurity of life and property, which leads to a cry for a stronger government to restore order, and the government ends up taking away freedoms and guns and all these rights, and you know, there's a loss of freedom, and eventually you'll have a totalitarian dictatorship which wants to track everybody like in China and take away your freedoms. And through history, there's been the death and enslavement of millions. So let's look a little closer at the French Revolution. So it began with an anti-Christian immoral agenda spreading through academia. There was philosopher Voltaire and then Rousseau, and then in entertainment, they had lewd theater, producing a population with weakened moral restraints, Then France had uncontrolled spending, including helping America gain her independence, which left them a lot of debt. Then there was a crop failure, and the people did not have food. Of course, Queen Marie Antoinette, when she was told the people didn't have bread, she responded, "Let them eat cake." She just grew up in court. But the population had been through this generation of free sex and anti-Christian influence, and now they had a shortage, and it turns into riotous mobs in Paris. They behead the king and queen, the royalty, the merchants, all those who were calling for moderation. And then the new leadership in France began to de-Christianize the country. And so they didn't want done in the year of the Lord for their republic constitution. So they made 1792 the new year one. They didn't want a 7-day week with a Sabbath rest because it went to the Bible. So they came up with a 10-day week, a decade week. Each day had 10 hours, each hour had 100 minutes, each minute had 100 seconds. They made every measurement in France divisible by 10. They said 10 was the number of man, 10 fingers and 10 toes. They called it the metric system. Maybe that's why I never really liked the metric system. They tore down churches, they turned them into temples of reason. They used them for all kinds of lewd, immoral orgies and so forth. And so we see that France wanted to de-Christianize itself, and then out of that confusion, that chaos, rose a dictator named Napoleon. He usurped power, crowned himself emperor, and then around 6 million died in the Napoleonic Wars. So we see this trend. Now, it goes back even as far as ancient Greece. So we have Plato. He was a Greek philosopher in Athens. He wrote a book in 380 BC called The Republic. He said that it would go through five stages. First was the rule of the capable, lovers of virtue, and these are people that know how to run farms and businesses, they know how to run city governments. They do a good job. A second group wants to get involved in politics. Plato called them lovers of fame. These are people that have no experience running anything. Maybe they just were an actor in the theater, that everyone knew their name, or they were an Olympic athlete, everybody knew their name, and because of their fame, they got elected. But because they loved fame so much, they hate being defamed. So these you could control with the swaying of public opinion. The first group will do what's right no matter what. Second group will bend the way the wind blows. And the second group, the lovers of fame, since they don't know how to run things successfully, they yield to avarice, selfishness, and they filter a little money out of the treasury, pad their retirement, funnel it to friends. It turns into a third category called lovers of money. It's an insider clique, a deep state, and everybody tries to get connections with those that are on the inside, and those that aren't have to bear the burden and the taxes. Turns into a division in society. Plato says that the people throw out the bums and set up a democracy. And he says the chief characteristic of a democracy is lovers of tolerance. Everybody learns how to tolerate each other. He said it's the most charming form of government. It's like a bazaar where you can buy any viewpoint. It's like an embroidery patchwork with lots of colors. It's great. And then they begin to tolerate people that are a little bit off. Then they tolerate people that are a lot off, until they're tolerating crooks and crime and fraud, and nobody cares. Nobody does anything about it. And then it creeps into the family, and the sons are disrespectful to the father, and if they get corrected, they just shake their head and walk away. And then Plato says that it creeps into the young man's morals. And he says the young man gives into libertinism and useless and unnecessary pleasures, even incest and unnatural union. Yes, that's what he's talking about. And it begins to cause there to be a loss of virtue and moral fiber for society. Plato goes on to say, the manner of life is that of democrats, because he's describing a democracy. Every man does what is right in his own eyes. So whatever you think is right for you, whatever your feelings are, right? You know, it's okay for you. So it turns into this moralist society out of chaos, and this chaos causes the people to want to beg for a leader, and somebody comes along promising to fix it. They yield all their power to this person, and this person ends up getting too much power. They cast it in his teeth, and he has a choice, give up the power, which he's not inclined to do because Plato called him a lover of power, or get rid of the people confronting him. So he purges his administration and his military of anybody with virtue. All he wants is yes men. And he finally stands in the chariot of state holding the reins of power, and he's revealed as the tyrant. So this concept in Athens that democracy without virtue ends in chaos out of which a tyrant arises. And so we look at the fall of the Hebrew Republic. And so the children of Israel came out of Egypt, and for 400 years they did not have a king. It was literally the first instance in world history of a nation with millions of people and no king. It was based on each citizen being taught the law. It's like everybody downloads a behavioral app on their iPhone. Instead of a GPS telling you where to turn, it tells you how to act. And the Levites are the computer geeks that help you to download this app. And so everybody's got their own, they know how to follow the law and the rules. And then the big question is, why would you follow these rules? Well, Israel introduces the key ingredient. There's a God who's watching everyone. He wants you to be fair, and he's going to hold you accountable in the future. So you're about to steal, nobody's around, and then you think, God is watching me. He wants me to be fair. He's going to hold me accountable. Maybe I should hesitate stealing. And it creates something in your head called a conscience. If everybody in the country really believes this, there'll be safety and security for life and property. Women can go anywhere without fear because everybody believes that God is watching them, wants them to be fair, going to hold them accountable. And so Israel's system worked for 400 years until the priests stopped teaching it, right? It's sort of like imagine every computer you buy is preloaded with a virus, this original sin. And the Israelites would take the kid to the Levite priest and say, recode this kid, right? Go to the Geek Squad table, say, recode this computer. And so the Levite would set the kid down and say, okay, you want to steal, don't steal. You want to lie, don't lie. You want to commit adultery, don't commit adultery. He's telling him to go against this draw, this selfish, fleshly pull. And he says, God's watching you, he's going to hold you accountable. So it worked as long as the priest taught it. When the priest stopped teaching the law, it fell apart. So the book of Judges gives an account of a Levite with a concubine. The law says the Levite's to marry a virgin of his own tribe. Here he is with the woman that he's not even married to. He's not following the law anymore. And they're traveling, and they're at a house surrounded by sodomites. Something about that behavior that appears at the very last stages of a people ruling themselves is casting off of restraint. The sodomites bang on the door. The poor girl's raped and dies. And by the time you're grossed out, you read this line that says, every man did what was right in their own eyes. Right? There we go again. There's no morals. So then we look at Eli, the high priest, the main guy who's supposed to be teaching the law in Israel. His own sons are sleeping with women in the tent of meeting with the Ark of the Covenant there. And so this lawlessness creeps around. It causes there to be domestic confusion. The people go to Samuel the prophet and they say, this self-government system's not working anymore. We want to be like all the other countries. We want a king. So a people ruling themselves without morals ends in chaos, out of which a king arises. And so Saul ends up taking away their best land, giving it to his favorites and determining their country. And one time as Saul is pouting that his son Jonathan made a friendship with David. And Saul said, nobody cares about me. And this guy Doeg the Edomite says, I care. I saw David go to the city of Nob. The priest gave him some bread and the sword of Goliath. Saul says, bring those priests here. Tells his men, kill them. The men hesitate. Doeg the Edomite says, I'll kill them. What just happened? The soldiers had been operating under the old system where each person is accountable to God personally to follow the law. And the law says you need two or more witnesses before you condemn somebody to death. There's only one witness, Doeg. So they're hesitating. This does not compute. Doeg says, King, I'm going to surrender my conscience to you. You tell me to kill, I'll kill. And so kings, governments, want you to surrender your morals and your values and just embrace what they tell you is the new moral, right? When Nebuchadnezzar blows those trumpets, you bow to a statue. He doesn't care if you have a warm feeling in your heart for the statue. You just obey the government. If the government says there's no more male and female, there's no more male bathrooms or female bathrooms, if anything goes, you have to surrender your values to the government. And so this is what happened in ancient Israel. And so we see, again, this trend that the loosening of sexual restraints has a larger agenda effect of destabilizing the country, and out of that confusion rises dictatorship. Now, in the biblical concept, the teaching of the law, it's so important to teach the law because without the law, people do not see their need for the Lamb. So you read the Old Testament, two things stand out. There's the law, there's the Lamb. And so we have churches that just teach God loves you. It's like, okay, so what? He loves me. No, you got to teach the law first. God is a just God, which means he has to judge every sin. If he doesn't judge the sin, he's giving consent to the sin. And guess what? He's not going to give consent to sin. So his very nature as a just God compels him to have to judge every single sin. And so God is just, but he's love in that he provides the Lamb to take the judgment for the sin. And so it's one strike and you're out. If you're going to go to heaven by being good enough, all you got to do is sin one time your entire life and you cannot go to heaven by being good enough. Whoa, this is serious. Okay, I got your attention. Now you see your need for the Lamb. Thank God for the Lamb. Jesus bore all my sins upon himself on the cross, right? So you have to preach the law before people see their need for the Lamb. Anyway, so this concept of cultural change, there was a guy named Antonio Gramsci, and he died in 1937. He was a Marxist thinker who advocated, saying, look, you can't conquer the America and the West on the battlefield. They're too strong. You have to destroy them from the inside. You have to make a long march through the institutions. And so you identify the institution of marriage and family and church and all these different things, and you want to cause them to rot from the inside. And so, believe it or not, the very first homosexual organization in America was started by communists. It's called the Mattachine Society. Now, why would the communists want to be involved in this? Did you know in 1963, there was a Congressman Herlong from Florida, and he actually read into the congressional record in Washington, D.C., the 63 goals that the communists have for America. Here's just a couple of them. Number 24, eliminate all laws governing obscenity by calling them censorship and a violation of free speech and free press. Number 25, break down cultural standards of morality by promoting pornography and obscenity in books, magazines, motion pictures, radio, and TV. Number 26, present homosexuality, degeneracy, promiscuity as normal, natural, and healthy. Number 40, discredit the family as an institution. Encourage promiscuity and easy divorce. Emphasize the need to raise children away from the negative influences of parents. Attribute prejudices and mental blocks and retarding children to the oppressive influences of the parents. This was 1963. He read these into the congressional record, and lo and behold, they've been being fulfilled. A couple more of them. Number 17, get control of schools. Use them as transmission belts for socialism, current communist propaganda, soften curriculum, get control of teachers' associations, put party line in textbooks. Number 18, gain control of student newspapers. 19, use student riots to foment public protests against programs and organizations which are under communist attack. Number 20, infiltrate the press. Get control of book reviewing assignments, editorial writing, policymaking positions. Number 21, gain control of key positions in radio, TV, motion pictures. 22, continue discrediting American culture by degrading all forms of artistic expression. An American communist cell was told to eliminate all good sculptures from parks and buildings, substitute shapeless, awkward, and meaningless forms. Number 23, control art critics, directors of museums. Our plan is to promote ugliness, repulsive, meaningless. Again, you want to break your identity with any type of respectable past to get you to let go of it. And then number 27, infiltrate churches. Replace revealed religion with social religion. Discredit the Bible and emphasize the need for intellectual maturity, which does not need religious crutch. Number 28, eliminate prayer or any phase of religious expression from the public schools on the ground that it violates the principles of separation of church and state. Number 29, discredit the American Constitution by calling it inadequate, old-fashioned, out of step, with so forth. Number 30, discredit the American founding fathers. Present them as selfish aristocrats who have no concern for the common man. So can you believe this? There's more of these, but I just wanted to give you a little taste. This was 1963. This is Antonio Gramsci. This is a long march through the institutions, causing America to decay from the inside. So one of the tactics they use is psychological projection. Sigmund Freud coined the term, where rude people call those they don't like rude. And so this is in the Bible. Potiphar's wife was the immoral one, right, wanting to lure Joseph into bed, yet she accused Joseph of being the immoral one, right? So little kids do this. I'm not the mean one, you're the mean one. So it's gotten into politics, where a corrupt politician will accuse their opponent of the very crime that they're guilty of. And so hateful groups that will call those they don't like hateful. They'll even put up a website and they'll list everybody that they hate, right? And so here you have Christians that are loving, but they're being called hate groups by the very people that are doing the hating. And so it's called psychological projection. And so it's gotten involved in politics. Don't have time to go into it all, but it's every day in the news, where you will see the news accusing somebody of doing something wrong when actually it's the person that's doing the accusing that's the corrupt person. Another tactic they use is victimhood. And so this is where the aggressor claims to be the victim in order to justify their aggression. So In Islam, a Muslim man will rape a woman and say, it's your fault for tempting me, right? So the attacker blames the victim. And so where Christianity teaches to forgive offenses, matter of fact, even extends the warning that if you don't forgive, you will not be forgiven. But the LGBT agenda doesn't have that. They don't have forgive offenses. They are constantly being offended, and they want you to give up your rights and freedoms so as to not offend them. And again, Sharia Islam practices the same thing. And so the perceived rightness of their agenda and the advancement of it overrides the rights of their opponents. Posturing themselves as the victims of offenses, they feel justified in retaliating. And they're never appeased. Why? Because lust is never satisfied. It always wants more. And so they do not just want to be tolerated, they become intolerant of those that disagree with them. They engage in reverse discrimination. They call it equity or ending Christian privilege. So in socialist and Sharia practicing countries, non-adherents are subjected to persecution, political imprisonments, labor camps, torture, and even death. In Russia, Lenin promised followers more freedom, but in the end, he set up an intolerant government which enslaved them. And he said, no mercy for these enemies of the people, these enemies of socialism, war to the death. So they want to be tolerated, but they will fight you and want to destroy you for not embracing them. In China, Mao Zedong promised followers more freedom, but now China is bulldozing churches and utilizing technology to track a billion people. In Islam, just the feeling of being threatened is enough to justify attacking a non-Muslim. This attitude carries over to the betrayal of those who have left their community. So if you want to see intolerance, see how the LGBT community treats those who have left their community. Or you see how those who have left the Islamic Ummah, the community, the imams say it's the death penalty. So another tactic they use is seizing the moral high ground. So even corrupt leaders want to appear righteous. This is where you have the gambling industry, and casinos will donate a portion of their money to the public school system and then say, we're in favor of children. If you really love children, you will support bill number such and such, which will allow casinos to expand, right? So they don't want to say, well, we're going to bring more crime and prostitution and drug dealing into your community. No, they want to appear. And so this is one of the tactics that's being used every day in the news. They'll name bills some nice name, but it actually does the opposite of what the name says, affordable health care, and it makes it unaffordable. So those undermining the Constitution want to appear as upholding the Constitution. President William Henry Harrison warned in his inaugural address that betrayers of democracy will seek a, quote, dangerous ascension to power amidst unusual professions of devotion to democracy. So who's in control? In America, the country is controlled by laws. Laws are controlled by politicians. Politicians are controlled by voters. Voters are controlled by public opinion, and public opinion is controlled by the media in the short run and education in the long run. So whoever controls media and education controls the country. As the old axiom goes, politics is downstream from culture. So if we're talking media and education controls the country, who controls media and education? Authority figures. And there is a tactic that can be manipulated. It's the desire of human beings to want to be accepted. This is one of the strongest motivations, that you want to be accepted by a group and honored by a group, and your biggest fear is being rejected by a group. And so this pressure to want to be accepted and honored in a group, there was an Ash conformity study in the 1950s, and they would have 8 students come into a room on college campus. 7 of them were paid actors, and only one was a naive participant. And the teacher would put 2 cards on the desk with a line on one card and 3 lines on the other card. And one of those 3 lines was clearly the exact length as the line on the one card. And so they would go around the room, starting with the paid actors. And one by one, these paid actors would convincingly say that the shorter line was equal to this other line on the first card. And when it finally got around to the naive participant, they would change their views, 30% of them, to fit in with the group. They would deny their own eyes. They would deny what is completely obvious because they didn't want to be shunned by a group. They didn't want to be ridiculed in front of the group. They doubted their own perception, right? And so this idea of wanting to fit in, they'll deny their own sexuality, they'll deny their own physical genitalia, they'll deny it all just because they want to fit in. And so another experiment was done. It's called the Spiral of Silence, Public Opinion, Our Social Skin. And this was a wine tasting experiment. And all these couples would come in with tables and different glasses of wine, have cards, and they'd mark which ones they like, which ones they don't like. Everybody in the room was an actor except for one couple. And they, again, do the same thing, go around the room, and they would all say that this horrible tasting wine was good, and this good tasting wine was terrible. When it finally got around to this last couple, they had scratched out on the card what they had put, and they agreed with the group. Why? Because there's this strong motivation to want to be accepted in the group. Now, this has been manipulated by those pushing the LGBT agenda, this desire to be in a group. So imagine the first day of class, students are sitting in their little desks. Teacher says, who believes it's normal to have a mommy and a daddy? And little Johnny raises his hand. And the teacher says, you're terrible. You're homophobic. You're a bigot. You're the worst kid in the whole world. You're evil. And then the teacher pauses and says, does anybody else believe what little Johnny does? All the other kids are like, well, I don't want to get yelled at. And so you ridicule and buffoon, you isolate. So Saul Alinsky, who was a community organizer, says ridicule is the most powerful weapon, that you pick a target, freeze it, isolate it, and destroy it. And so we see this in politics, right? In one of the past presidential campaigns, there was a candidate for vice president, was Sarah Palin, a wonderful woman, governor of Alaska. Well, the media decided that they were going to pick a target, freeze it, isolate it, and destroy it, right? And so everybody wanted to back away. And so this tactic is very powerful, this urge to want to fit into a group, this fear of leaving the group. And why is this important? Because now social media. So social media determines what's acceptable in the group. And so kids will even commit suicide if their online community group rejects them. They want to be accepted. They want to be honored. They want all those likes and so forth. And so this is now being manipulated through the elections. So Google is the largest search engine on the planet. 90% of all internet searches are Google. Robert Epstein documented how you have an election. There are those that are Republican no matter what, those that are Democrat no matter what, and then the undecideds. The undecideds want to look at candidates, so they go on to the search engine, they type in the name of the candidate. Well, the search results, they have algorithms that will pull up all the negative articles about one candidate and all the positive articles about another candidate. And this person doing the search wants to fit in with the group. He don't want to show up the next day at work and say, well, I like this guy. And they're all going to be, you like that guy? Nobody likes that guy. You're out of... So many elections are won by very slim margins that if they can swing through this desire to be accepted, just a percentage of the votes, they can determine the election. And so this gentleman, Robert Epstein, says his concern is that algorithms are going to determine all the future elections. And again, it goes back to people wanting to fit in with the group, and now it's the online community. So most cultures in the world are this way. They call them honor-shame cultures. They don't have a concept of absolute right and absolute wrong. What brings you and your family honor is good. What shames you and your family is bad. Some of them in, for example, Sharia Islam, that if the daughter shames and embarrasses the family, the parents will actually hold down and kill their own daughter because she embarrassed them in front of the community. Being accepted by the group is so important. And so this is the authority figure sets what's acceptable in the group. Kings and queens, the way they would dress, everybody would want to dress the way the king and do their hair like the queen, right? But now that's been usurped by the teachers in school, and by media. It sets what's acceptable in the group. And so these the Saturday Night Live, these different comedians, they'll ridicule certain ones, and then they'll have the different daytime talk shows, and they'll honor other ones and so forth. And so this desire to be accepted in the group has been manipulated to push this LGBT agenda, and again, which brings confusion, which will bring more of a lawlessness and then a cry for more government to restore order, out of which you'll come a totalitarian government. And so we look in China, They have a social credit system where the government is using technology to track every single citizen and have a social credit score. And even have apps where it will ding you if someone with a low credit score is in your vicinity so that you can back away and avoid them and shame them publicly. And people can't even get train tickets and so forth if their social credit score is too low. And if they snitch on their Christian neighbors and say they're having an illegal Bible study, their social credit score goes up. And so here they're using this desire to be accepted in this group. Now the group is the entire nation of China, that they want to be accepted, that they'll modify their behavior to fit in with the group. George Orwell wrote in his book, 1984, power is in inflicting pain. And so the LGBT agenda is taking control of the public opinion molding institutions in Western culture. They've effectively declared war on Judeo-Christian values. And they intend to pressure students to surrender their consciences, their morals, their souls to this new state belief system, a new religion, so to speak. Now, in ending, Jesus calls us out of the group. The word ecclesia, ek means out of, ecclesia means a calling, that the church, you're called out of the group. Jesus says that you have to love me more than being accepted by a group. You have to love me more than your mother, sister, brother, your family, or anybody. So you leave the fear of man to only fear God. Proverbs 29:25 says, the fear of man brings a snare, but he who trusts in the Lord will be exalted. Another Deuteronomy 1:17, you shall not fear man, for the judgment is God's. Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. I have indeed transgressed the commandment of the Lord because I feared the people and listened to their voice. Right? So here's Saul. He disobeyed the Lord because he was afraid of what the people were going to say. And Jesus said, I say unto you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body, and after that, no more. You'd be afraid of God, right? And Psalm 56, in God I have put my trust. I will not be afraid of what man can do to me. So the Bible is calling us to change our DNA. Instead of us being a group herding animal where we follow the herd, we're to be an independent animal, right? That we just have a relationship with God alone. And So a couple more stories. King Zedekiah, he is the last king of Judah. And you have the prophet Jeremiah comes to him, and Zedekiah says, prophet, does God have a word for me? And Jeremiah says, yeah. If you go out and surrender to the king of Babylon, you'll live. The city won't be burned. You know, your wife and kids and everybody will be fine. But if you don't, this whole place will be burnt. And your kids will be dragged away and be eunuchs in the palace of the king. And Zedekiah's response, he says, but what will the Jews in captivity say about me? Those Jews that are already there, what are they going to? He cared about man. He cared about what people are going to say about him. And here he was present, and sure enough, everything got destroyed. And so we see that the Bible calls us to be willing to say, we are no longer motivated to be accepted by a group. We just want to be accepted by God. And so we leave the honor shame culture. We come into the Christian belief system. We just want to have a relationship with God. We love other people. We treat other people. We may be accepted by them. We may not be accepted by them. But Jesus himself was rejected. And so we have to have backbone and say that we are going to follow God no matter what the world says. And that one has to love God more than being accepted by any group. More than being accepted by your mother, sister, father, brother, your synagogue, your classmates, your teammates, your political allegiances, that we're called out from the group to just be followers of Jesus and through him to have a relationship with the Father filled with the Holy Spirit. Thank you so much for watching this session.
If you've enjoyed this session of Biblical Worldview Sexuality, you may be interested in attending Charis Bible College. High in the Rocky Mountains, Charis Bible College is home to a vibrant and diverse community of believers. At Charis, we're dedicated to providing students with a biblical foundation and equipping our graduates with the skills necessary to be successful in any field of ministry. Our Spirit-filled instructors are committed to helping you discover God's purpose for your life.
If you sit under the Word of God 4 hours a day, 5 days a week for 2 or 3 years, you're going to get stronger than horseradish.
Discover God's purpose for your life at Charis Bible College. Change your life. Change the world. Visit charisbiblecollege.org to find out if Charis is the right choice for you.